Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, the lights of the night, stars who are your company, dance with you. Teach us the mystery of your dance, we may be in harmony with you. Learn to give away and renew. Oh, Moon Mother, your loving gaze falls softly on the sacred mountains. Oh, Moon Mother, your shining gaze falls softly on the sacred ocean.
Well, hello and welcome back to Voices of the Sacred Feminine again this Wednesday. I want to thank you for tuning in tonight, and my thanks also goes out to Lisa Thiel, one of the artists providing music for Voices of the Sacred Feminine. You were listening to a portion of her song called Moon Mother. And while I know most of you listen from the archives, I still want to remind you that you can call in and comment if you're listening live. Speak to me and or my guest. If you'd like to do that, the number is 718-766-4662. When I see your number pop up on the switchboard, as soon as we get a break in the conversation, I'll go in and have the opportunity to ask a question. Now, tonight, our guest is Rashid Erginer, author of Anatolia, Land of the Mother Goddess, and he's calling us from Turkey, where it's very early in the morning. He woke up at 4 a.m. to be with us today, so I thank him for starting his day early and sacrificing those last few hours of sleep. So we'll get to him in just a brief moment. And let's see, I want to also, for some continuity, our show ran long last week, and we didn't get to our What's the Buzz segment when I discussed the bees that have been buzzing around in my bonnet all week that address the ideals of the divine feminine as they relate to what's happening out there across the globe. So we'll catch up this week, I promise. And some of the topics are new, some are the ones lingering from last week. For instance, we're going to talk about the fact that just this past week, the Vatican and the Church of England both came out and commented on women's leadership in the church. So even though these churches have the same God, I guess God is whispering one thing in the Church of England's ear while he worships while he whispers something else in the Vatican's ear, because these two certainly don't have a meeting of the minds when it comes to women's ordination. We're going to talk about that. Another segue from there will be not just inequality for women in religion, but inequality for women in the workplace. We'll talk a bit about that. Also, across the globe, Australia welcomes its first female prime minister. Ethiopian female genital mutilation warnings are reaching nomadic women, so we'll talk a little bit about that. An AP report says there's over 150 million widows living in poverty. Deepak Chopra offers some insights into sex and spirituality. The Nation has an article out about women on top, discussing men's declining economic ability to dominate women and the sociocultural consequences of that fact. And we'll have a few more headlines, but that'll just sort of give you a taste, along with some very funny and upbeat things, too, that I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing about. So that sort of takes care of the business of the show and what's going to be happening tonight. So I want to turn my attention to our guest and not have him waiting too much longer. And again, I thank him for being with us at this challenging time. So let me tell listeners a bit about Rashid Erginer, because I'm sure his name might not be familiar to a lot of folks here in the West yet. So they have a bit of context for our interview. Let me tell you about his impeccable credentials. Dr. Erginer received his training in economics at Yale and Oxford universities. He's been teaching economics at Bosphorus University in Istanbul since 1987. Currently, his teachings and research are focused on the relationship between religion and economics. He's written several papers on this, and he's working on a book of the same subject. In 87, he published a book entitled Anatolia, Land of the Mother Goddess, studying the history and presence of the great goddess in Turkey. And since 1990, Rezit has led many group tours in Turkey by the title of Trail of the Great Goddess. And he might just be doing that tour for me. I've been tempting you with and sending you, you know, tantalizing little tidbits for the last few weeks. So, Rashid, thank you so very much for being with us this morning. This morning to you, the tonight to us.
It's my pleasure.
So let me ask you, let's, you know, sort of just start at the beginning. You know, most people here in the West aren't familiar with the term Anatolia. Could you speak a little bit about where that word comes from and the meaning of it?
Anatolia is from the Greek term Anatol, meaning source or spring. And it was thought the name was given to the land, and that's the portion of Turkey which is in Asia. Anatolia is the portion of Turkey which is in Asia, which is 97% of Turkey. It was thought that the name was given to the land because this is the land for the Greeks where the sun rises. And now we know, however, that the name is given to the land because central Turkey was the source of food for the East Roman Empire. Anatol, source of food. In Turkish mouth, when Turks came to Turkey in the 11th century, they adopted the name Anatol for the whole province, for all of Asia province. And the name changed to Anadolu, meaning land full of mothers. Very appropriate name for the land where metropolitan civilization started, Neolithic metropolitan civilization started in southeast Turkey, led by women.
And major focal civilizations is Çatalhöyük, correct? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, yes, you are. Southeast Turkey is the home of wild grains and also of stock animals. And so far as I know, the existing evidence indicates that's where food was cultivated and animals were domesticated. And it's very likely that that process was, processes were initiated and led by women. And the early Neolithic societies from that area seem to be very egalitarian, with no social stratification, no wealth accumulation, no gender differences with regard to lifestyle. And Çatalhöyük, of course, is one of those societies, and remarkably, it is one of the largest Neolithic societies ever discovered. Several thousand people, we don't know exactly how many, lived together peacefully for several thousand years at Çatalhöyük without any war, without any evidence of social stratification, kingship, or priesthood, in an egalitarian manner. And it looks like the evidence can be interpreted, though not all archaeologists agree, that it was a society where mothers were venerated and held in high regard.
Well, Rashid, let me ask you, why do you think, for instance, like the archaeologist in residence there, Ian Hodder, why does he have such a hard time coming to the same conclusion that yourself and so many feminists and Maria Gambutis and James Mellert, what's his problem? I mean, why does he see this differently?
Well, I have great regard for Ian Hodder. I mean, we were with him actually a few days ago. It's very hard to say. But I think this concept of a goddess society is a society dominated by women like patriarchies are dominated by men. And he keeps pointing out that at Chipotle, there was no such domination. And I and several others have pointed out to him that the fact that there is no evidence of domination by any group is actually a sign of godless society. And that point does not seem to get across to him. I don't know why.
So in other words, you're saying he thinks those of us who think alike, you know, who believe this this was a matriarchal society, believe that women were in control, where we're really saying no, there was equality of the genders, this was an egalitarian society, and so it's a definition problem.
Yes. It is a definition problem. And somehow he has the concept that as I just said, godless society means a society dominated by women.
Okay. Now, last time I was there at Chateau Hayuk, last fall, we took a group there, and it was pretty quiet there. There wasn't really a guide to take us around. And I know when you first enter, over to the right, they've reconstructed what it might have looked like inside one of the homes. You actually get to crawl in there, and that was very interesting. We really enjoyed seeing, you know, what a house, you know, for people of the time would have looked like. And then as you walked further, you came to, you know, the dig that was, you know, under the big awning. And then, of course, you walk much further back, and there's an even bigger dig. What I wondered was that goddess that is in the Anatolian Museum, I don't know, I sort of call her the ancestor of Kabeli, where she's seated on the throne with the two lions on either side that was found in the grain bin. Where at the site did they actually find that statue? Can you explain that to me, or is it hard without looking at a map?
No, I can't tell you. You said you walked at the dig site and then to the larger dig site.
Yes.
Right? Larger dig. The goddess was discovered not by the current team, but by James Maynard. As you are walking to the larger dig site before you entered, to the right of it. Walking towards it. Yes.
Okay, well, you know, then, you know, one of the guard at the site was correct then. That's actually where he told us, but, you know, I wasn't sure if that was accurate. So, okay. What's the plan there? Are they going to, I mean, because that whole mound, I guess, that you walk on from the visitor center all the way back past the biggest, you know, the biggest, deepest dig site. I mean, that whole area, I mean, underneath there is more of the same. Isn't there? There are levels of houses, dating back 10,000 years. Do you think that's ever going to all be uncovered?
Well, to uncover all of it would take a long time, especially with the techniques archaeologists are using now, which is very slow. They analyze every cubic inch of earth they unearth. So they're moving very slowly. That won't be done. And also they are saving some levels. When they find a nice house, they try to save it. So it deteriorates. It's very hard to save those levels. But I don't think they will ever uncover the hole.
So it's probably, well, to preserve it, it's better to keep it underground.
Underground is the best way to preserve it, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, why don't you tell us, tell us a bit more about the goddess mother of Chateau Hayuk.
Well, at Chateau Hayuk, there is that figure which was discovered. You call her the grandmother of Sibyl, right?
How I refer to her. Is that accurate? Because you're more
than
expert, certainly.
Well, it is. You can think of it, yes, that way. I call her as Anna of Anatolia, Anna being the universal name, one of the universal names for the Great Mother.
Okay.
She's eaten, flanked by two leopards, and possibly giving birth. A very majestic, made up of rounded teeth, signifying fertility. And she is one of the several female figurines discovered at Çatalhöyük. And they also found some male figurines, but looks like there are more female figurines, usually giving birth and holding the breast, holding the waist, emphasizing fertility. But one point made by the archaeologists is that those figurines are discovered, they're concentrated at one level. And that level happens to be the level when they started agriculture. And so then one point they make is that there is no continuous worship of the goddess. And they refuse to acknowledge them as goddesses. They say they are toys or just female figurines in general.
Or Barbie dolls.
But, yeah, or baby dolls, yes. And they also point out that they... where they were found, there was no significance with the location. However, it's very hard to know where things were actually used in Çatalhöyük because having lived in a hut for a certain amount of time, maybe 6-7 decades or 100 years, people abandoned the house. They demolished it, filled it up with dirt, and went up again on it, on the same hut. But before
they
abandoned it,
they built
up.
Built on a higher level.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before they abandoned the hut, they emptied it. Therefore, it's very hard to know when objects were actually used.
So what the archaeologists are uncovering are really, in a lot of cases, an abandoned house, so it's not an accurate snapshot of how people were actually living in the space. Is that what you mean?
Yes. Like it's also hard to establish if like they have altars where they would venerate these objects, because the house would have been empty by that time. So if those goddess figurines were objects of worship, cannot be established by the use of the hut.
So then what criteria is used to, to come to the conclusion that the figurines represented the worship of in a goddess culture?
That's a very good question. There is the continuity of similar objects used in various cultures through time and also through Neolithic. You see lots of those figurines, which makes one think that they had some significance. And also, I think it's a matter of faith, frankly. You look at that figurine, it was attacked by the leopards, and you think that's a goddess. Looks so magnificent, so different from others.
Well, let me put this to you and just get your... scholarly opinion. I know I attended a lecture at a college of religion, and a guest speaker was talking about these Neolithic artifacts found in Israel, and she called them goddesses as opposed to just fertility images or, Barbie dolls or something like that. And she gave three reasons that more scholars were coming to the belief that what they're finding, actually points to veneration of goddess. One was, as you already said, in Çatalhöyük, so many more images were found of females than males. They were usually found in places that seemed to be sacred places, and they were made of the best quality materials of the time, and they were the quality of the pieces seemed to suggest maybe by the best artists. So to put all of that effort into it, you know, coupled with these other ideas, it had to be more than a toy. It had to be something that was, you know, important to the people and perhaps would equate with religious significance. I mean, do you agree with that theory?
I do, but it's Chapalhuk, except for that goddess figurine which was found in a granary, the great mother figurine, Anna of Anatolia. We don't really know if they were in special places. Like in Israel, do you say they were?
Right. But to find her in a granary, would that be suggestive of the fact that she provided their daily bread, I mean their sustenance to live?
Yes, yes. And that she contributed to fertility.
Okay.
That would be, yes.
Okay. So now you called...
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
It also, those... you remind me of another point, argument I used to make. The in a patriarchal society, like when Odysseus Town kills his mother, he is acquitted of the crime because the mother had no right on him. He had murdered the murderer of his father, so that was justified. The mother had no right on the son she had given birth to. She was just the field where the father had planted the seeds. This approach, this very patriarchal approach, is quite different from the attitude to birth, the approach to birth and to motherhood in general at Chapalhuk, where those objects of mothers giving birth honor them, exalt them. There's a respectful, honoring attribute to motherhood, whether they were goddesses or not. It's quite a different approach to mothers in general.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay. Well. Now, I know I used your book to help, you know, teach people that came on my last trip, and I thank you for providing that for me. It was very helpful. And in it, you talk about you believe women were the creators or founders, I'm not sure which word to use, but they discovered agriculture. Can you explain what you mean by that? How does one create or discover agriculture?
Well, the discovery of agriculture should have been a very complicated process and lots of trials and errors, but one theory is it started as the last glacial age ended, and as the game moved further and further away, men were chasing the game, and women were more stationary with their offspring, and they were doing the food gathering. And they were also gathering wild grains, which were available in the area. And they would bury some of the grains they had collected for storage, or some would drop. And they noticed that where they buried them, or where they dropped, perhaps, they noticed that the seeds sprouted again. And through such observations and trial and error, it's more likely that women, rather than men, started agriculture. And they also domesticated animals, attending them with their own offspring. Basic trades like pottery and weaving are also attributed to women by Golden Child, the great archaeologist. And I think there's probably truth to all this.
That okay.
In later centuries, definitely those activities stay in the realm of women.
Now, when you say domesticated animals, I'm wondering, I mean, we think maybe, I guess, cattle, chickens, things like that. But when you look at Kibeli with the two leopards on either side of her, do you think there's a chance they actually ever domesticated, you know, these big feline cats? Or what do you think these feline cats represent?
You probably know Inadvar attaches great importance to the leopard at Çatalhöyük, those feline cats. His book on Çatalhöyük is called Leopard's Tale. And he recently pointed out that with the Selçuk Turks, who are much later than Çatalhöyük, of course, in Turkey, 4,000 years later, they were using those feline cats, cheetahs, in hunting. The cheetah would be riding behind the Selçuk Turk on the horse and would go and chase the game they were hunting. So it's possible that there could have been some kind of domestication relationship between humans and those felines at Çatalhöyük also.
Okay. Well, before we move over to the Fergie and Kibeli, is there anything else you wanted to make sure we know about Çatalhöyük or the goddess of Çatalhöyük?
Our hunter-gatherer ancestors were egalitarian. They were peaceful, no wars. And Çatalhöyük kind of society is the translation of that egalitarian human existence to sedentary living. And it continued for several centuries, up really until the Bronze Age when stratification and war start. And it's our hope and dream maybe to recreate that golden age in the future.
Well, that would be a good thing. Do we know how Çatalhöyük civilization ended? Is there any evidence that could hint at how it all, you know, disintegrated?
Not that I know of. Ian Hodder thinks that the memory of the ancestors people were attached to faded. He thinks that they were worshipping more their ancestors rather than goddesses.
Okay.
And the memory of those ancestors faded. But I don't know, we don't really know how Çatalhöyük ended. But the end of Çatalhöyük is not the end of egalitarian societies. It goes on. There are many more egalitarian societies for several thousand years, actually.
So where were these other societies? Are you talking about there in Anatolia?
In Anatolia and elsewhere until the Bronze Age, which is about 2500 BC or beyond 2000 BC. You don't really have kinships, social stratification, war, wealth accumulation. Çatalhöyük ends about 5500, so another 2500 years or so, or 3000 years, you do have egalitarian societies like Çatalhöyük. Çatalhöyük is the big, yeah.
So, Rashid, why do you think so many, well, I mean, and I'm making an assumption here, and let me say that if I'm wrong, you don't have to worry about telling me I'm wrong. It's perfectly okay, because I'm here to learn, and my listeners are here to learn. If there were more egalitarian societies, why do you think we don't hear about them? I mean, we hear about Çatalhöyük, but I don't know, even within goddess studies, I don't know about a lot of other ones. Is it just the patriarchy wants to sort of, shove that under the rug, so to speak, hide the idea that life can be structured a different way? Can it be that simple of an answer? Or is it just maybe scholars don't agree that there were so many egalitarian societies. They want to believe that there had to be war and people couldn't get along and the genders weren't living in equality.
It's a very good question why we don't hear more about those egalitarian societies. Well, of course, with Mesopotamia, you have the emergence of end of egalitarian societies about, I think, 2000. Maybe it's because they had a high quality of life, but did not produce as much. They didn't produce the monuments. They didn't have the big empires. They were happily existing, but didn't create the monuments. But though Catholic is extremely beautiful art, and other Neolithic societies, or egalitarian societies, not only Neolithic, had beautiful art, but on small scale. And it's not the big history that we are used to that catches attention, maybe. But we are now, it's possible now, I think, with the resources available to humankind, to accomplish great things and be egalitarian at the same time.
Well, and maybe I'm just speculating here. Maybe they just had a different set of values. You know, the big monuments maybe weren't what was important to them. You know, maybe their quality of life was more important, and you know, they didn't measure their quality of life by having big monuments. I don't know.
Definitely. I mean, just look at the pyramids. Behind the big monuments, there's the misery of many, 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 many people who had to give up their quality of life and even their life for the sake of the big monument, for the grandeur of the palaces, of the upper classes.
Right.
But that's
right.
History. Yeah. That's the history which catches the attention.
Right, right. It has to be big and flashy or it's not worth talking about.
Yes.
All right, well, let's go ahead and move over to Phrygian Kybele. What should we know about her?
The Phrygian Sibyl, Kybele, yes. Phrygians are very interesting people. If they had more than one deity, we don't know. It is as if they were monotheists, and the single deity they were worshipping was a female. Who they called as Mater, Mother, Mater, M-A-T-E-R, and with several titles like Agdistis, meaning of the rocks, or Kubilae, meaning of the mountains. And from her title, Kubilae, Greeks adopted her as Kybele, and they honored her as the mother of gods. But with the Phrygians, Kybele was one of her titles only. And she was worshipped at high places and mountains, and also at city gates, where wilderness met civilization. Even though she is the mother, we don't know. So far, there is no evidence that she had children in her mythologies or in her images, or there is no evidence of a male consort either. She's shown alone. When she's shown with others, those are supernatural beings. And she's a symbolizing great mother. She does have an affair with Attis, and Attis marries falls in love with a human, the daughter of King of Tessinus, which annoys the great mother, and drive artists to madness, to insanity, and in his insanity, artist castrates himself and bleeds to death. From his blood grows the flower anemone. But this version of the story, this story is told by Romans.
So it's a later story. Does that mean it's a later story? It's not an early story?
Yes, if it is an early story, we don't know of its existence amongst the Phrygians, which doesn't mean it didn't exist, but there is no evidence of that. And the story is told by Christian authors who may have wanted to turn people off from the religion of the goddess.
A couple questions for you. When she was seen with supernatural beings, what or who were they? And when we say Phrygian, are we talking about the area, the people that came from the area that we now know as Turkey?
Supernatural beings are like her companions playing the double flute or the lyre. Don't quite look like humans, like jinns accompanying her. Phrygians ruled central Turkey, central and northwestern Turkey, like the capital Ankara, and to the west and north, and also toward the south. They are a people, probably a Slavic people, who moved into Turkey in about 1200 BC, together with the other so-called sea peoples. And we see them, initially, we don't know about their kingdoms, about their government, but in the 9th century BC, we see them with a kingdom with capital in Gordion. It's actually a patriarchal horse-riding aristocracy. And this is one of the problems which intrigued me, why these patriarchal warrior peoples had a goddess. With Çatalhöyük, it was a peaceful, egalitarian society. And their association with a goddess seems natural, but why these warrior people said the goddess? And it says if they had only a goddess, no other gods, is an intriguing question.
So do you think she was a war Kabeli or Çebeli was a war goddess?
No, not at all. She was taming, civilizing mother.
Yeah, so that is kind of perplexing, isn't it? It seems like there's part of the story must be missing.
You can think of it as the most simple explanation is, which I mentioned, I think, in my book also, that as these conquerors came to ancient Turkey, they were taken over by the cult of the mother. And in many cases, they co-opted the cult of the mother. That's one explanation.
They just sort of included her in their religion or their mythology, then, you mean?
Yes. But Sibyl is not only included, she is the only one. Kibele is the only one with the Phrygians. So very intriguing.
Right. Interesting. Now, wasn't she also worshipped as in the form of a meteorite?
Well, her essence was a sacred stone. This sacred stone we will also see with Artemis, Diana of Ephesus. And also at the Muslim shrine Mecca, there was a sacred stone representing the goddesses worshipped there before Islam. So the sacred stone, a meteorite, yes, is her essence. And when Rome was threatened by
Hannibal?
Hannibal, yes, from North Africa. The Sibylline prophets advised them that unless they bring the sacred stone representing Sibyl or Kibele to Rome, they'd be doomed. So they persuade her priests to bring the stone to Rome, 204 BC, and Rome was saved. That's how her cult was planted in the West, transplanted in the West.
Now, that meteorite stone, did that come from Pessinus there in Turkey?
That was her cult center, yes, Pessinus.
But now they haven't uncovered her actual temple there, have they?
No, there's a temple there which is probably an emperor's temple. And there's no evidence that underneath there was a Sibyl temple, but there could have been. Somewhere in Pessinus, there should be her shrine yet to be discovered.
Because that was a major cult center of hers, wasn't it?
That was, so far as I know, the cult center of Kibele. Though, a very good archaeologist who's worked on Phrygians claims that her sacred stone went to Rome from Pergamum rather than Pessinus. By that time, 204 BC, the stone had moved to Pergamum, the capital of the Hellenistic kingdom in that area.
Ah, okay. So the cult center moved from Pessinus to Pergamum.
Pergamum, yes.
Isn't it strange though that there's been no temple found in Pessinus? I mean, do you think there wasn't one, or you think we just haven't uncovered it yet?
According to ancient sources, there should be one. But it was rebuilt during the Roman era. And it's quite possible that Romans built over it, eradicated. I think Romans make an effort. These cult centers were often centers of not only of religious authority, but also of political authority. The cult would command lots of resources, and people had respect for the priests. And I think Romans would make an effort to take over the political authority from the priests. And
so
in some cases,
they co-opted her temple and turned it into another use?
Yes. In some cases, they would retain the ancient cult center and include the goddess or the god into the Roman pantheon. But simultaneously, they would introduce the worship of the emperor of Rome, which was a way to introduce the secular Roman authority, imbuing it with sacredness. It's possible that at Pessinus, they destroyed the Kibele center altogether.
Well, I've read, and please tell me if this is accurate, that the Romans weren't really crazy about Kibele. So would that, if that's true, would that have been incentive for them to, get rid of her temple?
You said they were not crazy about Kibele?
I've read in Rome they didn't really appreciate her rituals, so I wonder if the same thing occurred in Turkey. Maybe the Romans didn't like Kibele's, and her rituals in Turkey either. I don't know. I'm asking your expert opinion.
It's possible. Yes, that's possible. But also, as I was saying, they didn't like the authority of the ancient priests, of the priests of these ancient cults. and they want to get rid of them in general so that they could impose Roman authority.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, and now later on, Cabelli, I think you say, starts to be worshipped as other goddesses, Artemis, Aphrodite, Kubaba.
There are at least two well-known instances where the great mother of Anatolia, or when one of the female members of the Greek Roman pantheon assumes the nature of the great mother. One is Aphrodite at Aphrodisias, which was an ancient cult center dedicated to Nana. Great mother is Nana. And at that cult center, Aphrodite is transformed and becomes the great mother. She's
now,
I'm sorry.
I don't mean to interrupt you. Did you say Inanna?
Nana.
Oh, Nana.
Inanna is a similar name. Nana, Anna, Hanna. Those are universal names for the great mother.
Okay.
Very common name. And the previous name of Aphrodisias was Ninoe, dedicated to Nana or Nina. And so the Greeks, Romans come, and people are worshipping Nana. This is, I'm projecting a scenario now. And they want to co-opt her. So one of their goddesses, Aphrodite, becomes Nana. She takes over her powers, her appearances, ceases to be the goddess of love only, and becomes the great mother. And in a similar manner at Ephesus, when the Greek colonizers arrived, one of their female deities, Artemis, is merged with the personality of Cybele, who was worshipped at Ephesus.
Well, and we see that actually in their statues, don't we? I mean, the Aphrodite at Aphrodisias has these reliefs that show her as, you know, mistress of the animals, just like, you know, very, in a way, sort of similar to all the animals that are on the torso of Artemis. So in these statues,
yes,
are we seeing the shift or metamorphosis from, you know, Nana or Magda Mater or Cybele to Artemis and Aphrodite?
I think so, yes. That's how I can explain it.
Okay.
That's it's the merging of the Anatolian concept of the Great Mother with one of the female members of the Greek-Roman pantheon.
Okay, so all right, so we know when you know, the Greeks and Romans show up, we end up with Artemis, Aphrodite. Well, and I guess Kubaba, is she more from like Mesopotamia area a little bit? Or no, what culture is Kubaba?
Kubaba is also, Kubaba is Hittite.
Hittite, okay, Hittite.
Hittite.
So, well, no, finish about Kubaba.
No, she can, it's being suggested that she's from Cybele also, but she could be an independent deity. The name, it's possible, has a different source.
Okay.
So, I'm listening to you, yes.
Yeah, because Kubaba sounds a lot like Cybele, or Cybele, seems to be some similarities there, maybe. I'm not a linguist, but... okay, so we see the Great Mother, you know, morphs into Artemis, Aphrodite, maybe Kubaba, and then Christianity comes along. So does then Mary become the successor of all these goddesses that came before her in this region of the world?
Yes. Before we move into that, there's also the worship of Isis in Anatolia. And throughout the Roman world, the Egyptian deity Isis is also very popular in Anatolia. Now, Mary images of Mary with Christ is very resemble most closely of all pagan deities, Isis, with her offspring. Statues of Isis looks resemble Mary most amongst all pagan goddesses. It was initially in Christian theology, Mary is not very important. It was only at the Council of Ephesus, 432 AD, that she was given the title Mother of God. And from then on, her veneration spreads amongst the Christians. And it is not a coincidence, probably, that it was at Ephesus, at the seat of the last of two great goddesses, that Mary was accepted as the Great Mother. At Ephesus, as I'm sure you noticed, there was a great veneration of Artemis into Christianity. At one of the monuments at Ephesus, the Christian Emperor Theodosius is shown together with Artemis in order to exalt the emperor. People have this identification of a great deity with a goddess. And the presence of Mary as a female mother possibly fulfilled that need.
So you're saying the Christians couldn't convince their converts, you know, the people they were trying to convert from paganism to Christianity. They basically just, they wouldn't give up their mother, so they gave them Mary in place of the goddesses?
Well, sort of like that, yes. But also, you know, later Christianity becomes very much identified with patriarchy. At the beginning of our talk, you were talking about the Catholic Church and how they don't ordain priestesses. But with early Christianity, there were probably priestesses. Women did play an important role. And Christianity actually was a very appealing religion for women. There's a very good Christian author, Rodney Stark, who wrote a book on the rise of Christianity. And he argues that Christianity spread slowly and surely through good deeds. Early Christianity was quite different from what Christianity became during the later centuries, and what it is now with some denominations. It was not big temples, not big expenditures, but good deeds to others. Help others in need. When there is a epidemic, help the person who is affected rather than run away from the person. So after each epidemic, more Christians would survive because they would then help each other. And also, more amongst the survivors, there'd be more who had been helped by Christians who would then convert. And with women, Romans had these goddesses who they retained in their pantheon, but it was an extremely patriarchal society. The father could decide if children could live or not. There is, Stark, I think, again, mentions the letter of a Roman gentleman, very loving letter to his wife, and then he says, she's pregnant, apparently. If it is a boy, he says, keep it. If it's a girl, give it away. Put it out on the agora. They would often kill female offspring. They found lots of fetuses dumped on Roman sewage systems. Women married young were forced to abort using very crude means, which would impair them permanently or kill them. So So you can, and then, of course, Roman husbands had their mistresses, had their concubines, totally immoral life. And Christianity, no matter what you think of abortion now, at the time, abortion was forced on women, which damaged them. So Christianity was against that practice, against the amoral behavior of husbands, and attracted lots of women. It was women who converted then the family members, the slaves, as good husbands into Christianity. So it's not only a matter of selling Christianity, I think, to pagans. It sort of made headway through women for good reasons with early Christianity.
I see.
Later, okay. I think Christianity is taken on an entirely different course by patriarchs.
I see.
Also, okay. Rodney Stark points out that there is a correlation between the presence of goddess temples and the spread of Christianity. He thinks goddess temples introduced the concept of salvation, being good as a way to attain salvation. Greek-Roman religion was very amoral in the sense they'd be giving gifts to gods, hoping the gods and goddesses would reciprocate. And you could wish anything, good or bad. Socrates says that we are lucky that not all gifts are wishes are granted by gods and goddesses. Otherwise, there wouldn't be anybody left living, because you could wish for the death of persons also.
I see.
But goddess religion introduced salvation, and that paved the way to Christianity, thinks this scholar. So there are very complicated links between goddess, Mary, and Christianity.
I see. That's very, very interesting. So does goddess civilization end with as people, adopt Christianity?
I don't think so. I think of goddess civilization as a civilization of universal love, equality. Religions can define membership in one religious group, and with total indifference to the members of other groups, or exploiting them, or killing them, members of other groups. And there's also, however, a universal religion, which is love of all humankind, of nature and environment as a whole. And I think of Buddhist religion as the second kind of religion, which is universal. And Christianity didn't kill that. One aspect of Christianity is it's the religion of love, which is then taken on a different course. So it's not with Christianity. It is, I don't think other civilization ends. I think the message of love is still with us.
Well, and that I think would make people think of Jesus. Jesus, a lot of us say Jesus was probably a feminist. Maybe he was a Gnostic. But he certainly doesn't. He doesn't look like the Christianity we see today, because he was about love. But Christianity today doesn't often feel like they're much about love. So I can see Jesus fitting into the goddess ideal.
I think so also.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Now, you wanted to mention something about the Trojan legend, though, that it signified something important?
Well, that's about 1200 BC. There's the invasion of ancient Turkey by the Sea Peoples. Who they are, we don't know. But it looks like, the Trojan War, at Troy, women are freely moving around. There's no evidence, no mention of slavery at Troy. They go to war for Helen, who has run away with the prince, rather than return her due to their saved lots of trouble. But look at the attacking Mycenaeans. They have sacrificed the daughter of the great king to get good wings at the beginning. They have slavery. When Agamemnon, the great king, has taken as concubine the daughter of a priest of Apollo, and he is forced to return her because that they believe brings them bad luck. And when he does so, he's compensated with the slave of Achilles. So their women are slaves. Their women are sacrificial creatures, including their own daughters. And obviously a more warrior, more brutal society. And one of the reasons maybe why Trojan War catches so much attention is that it is the domination of the more egalitarian, more gender-wise, and another term, society, by this more patriarchal society.
Right. So would it
maybe it may be a symbolic turning point?
So that yes. that might have been patriarchy versus egalitarian.
Yes.
So would it be a natural extrapolation to say then, before you were just talking about how hard women had it in Rome, that Christianity in that time looked like a better choice for them. Are we saying then that by the time Christianity comes along, egalitarian society maybe in Troy is not happening anymore? I'm not clear on the timeline, because I guess I'm thinking I can see choosing a better Christianity if it gave them a better life than patriarchal Roman society, but would Christianity have been a better choice over egalitarian Trojan society?
That's a difficult question. That's
Hard to know without a time machine, right?
yes.
Okay. Well,
very good question, yes.
So last question for you. Relics of goddess traditions still present in Turkey. What did you want to share with our listeners about that?
Well, some of the symbolism was with us. Like amulets are designed like triangles very often. Or the number 3 continues their significance, like folk tales start with 3 apples dropping from heaven. And brides wear red attire on Turkish carpets. A very popular design is hands on the waist, which, according to Menard, who discovered Çatalhöyük, goes back to Çatalhöyük. And even if not, it does carry some, because that's not really proved, it does carry definitely religious significance for the nomadic women who weave them, who will be performing rituals before weaving such designs. And also, there is in our culture, even though it is a patriarchal society, within the family at least, there's great veneration of the mother, cult. The name, yes.
No,
the name Tibere. Sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
And the name Tibere. Maybe Kibale means with midwife. Kibale, maybe from Kibale, midwife. In the the in a town called Manisa, which is was one of her cost centers. Annually, they throw away little packs of paste from the minarets of the local mosque, and people believe that this paste has aphrodisiac powers, a relic of maybe of the fertility cult of the Great Mother. So in little waves like this, these many, there are leftovers of various traditions, plus the veneration, the great importance attached to the mother. In our museums, Turkey is a Muslim country, and worship of a pagan goddess deity would not be accepted. However, in our museums, goddesses are called goddesses, not fat female figurines.
Right.
The problem is that.
Yeah, I did. Because I think in the Louvre, even, I don't think the goddesses are named goddesses all the time, which surprised me. But
yeah.
But in Turkey, they are called goddess.
Yeah, you couldn't bring people to the cult of the mother. That would be a very difficult job. But on the other hand, there's no problem with acknowledging the presence of the cult of the Great Mother, of the Mother Goddess in Turkey.
So if I'm understanding you right, of course they don't call themselves pagans, but within the Muslim culture, they sort of tolerate this idea of the past because they have such veneration for the mother? Is that what you're saying?
They together they have I don't know if it's because of that, but they have respect for the mother, definitely in the family. And our country is motherland, not fatherland. Turkey is motherland for Turks, not fatherland.
Okay.
There is the veneration of the mother, and they have no problems acknowledging the worship of a mother goddess in the past.
Okay, all right. Unlike in Malta, when I led a tour to Malta, the tour guides were telling people that what we call the fat ladies, our beloved fat ladies, they were telling people not that they were goddesses, they were telling them they were sumo wrestlers.
Really?
Seriously, it was unbelievable. Well, Rashid, we have someone who showed up on the switchboard a few minutes ago, and I'm going to check and see if they're just listening or if they have a question for you. So, caller, if you, I'm going to go into the switchboard now and see if you have a question for our guest, Rashid. Hi, are you there? Hello?
Yes, I.
Did you have a question for Rashid? Hello? Okay, caller, left, are you there? If you have a question, please speak up now, okay? All right, well, I guess they're just listening. That's okay. Well, Rashid, is there... this has been a wonderful conversation, and I thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to say that I haven't thought to ask that you'd like our listeners to know about?
I cannot think of any at this point. I enjoyed the conversation very much. Yes.
I am sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you. I'm just jumping in here. I'm glad you enjoyed the conversation. It's been very enlightening. You've taught me a lot tonight. And I'm wondering, is your book available? If listeners wanted to get a copy of it, are there copies available anywhere?
I think if you search with used books, dealers, you can find a copy. People do. that it exists in some libraries in the United States, and hopefully I'll be doing a new edition. But at the moment, there are a few copies still in circulating with old book, with used book dealers
okay.
on the internet.
Well, I have a copy, and I am so grateful. I guard it with my life. So, listeners, if you can find a copy of Rashid's book, the title again is Anatolia, Land of the Mother Goddess, grab it, because it is a very, very, very good book. Well, Rashid, I guess I will let you go have your breakfast now, and please tell my friend Lydia Rule good morning, and I hope she's enjoying her tour with you there in Turkey, and she'll be on the show in just a couple weeks, so I'll be talking to her soon.
We are on our way to Pessinus and Maida City, where the Sibyl altars are today.
Ah. Oh, I wish I was there with you. Well, thank you so much for calling
thank
in.
You.
I really appreciated it. Appreciate it. Good night.
Thank you. I truly enjoyed it. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, I hope you will stay on with me for the rest of the show. I'm going to get into the bottom of the hour with some of those topics I mentioned, what's the buzz. But I am going to take a very brief break for no more than a minute. And while I do, I'm going to leave you listening to Corn Mother by Lisa Thiel. So if you, by some chance, just tuned in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, and it is here we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she, as I like to call her, whether we talk about her in terms of being a deity, an archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just may save the world. And our guest tonight was Rashid Erginer, author of Anatolia, Land of the Mother Goddess. And I'm so glad he was with us tonight. So here for a minute is Corn Mother. Give me just a few seconds here to get ready for the bottom half of the hour, and I'll be right back. So please stay with me.
Sacred Corn Mother, come to me. Make my way sacred, fill me with beauty. Sacred Corn Mother, come to me. Make my way sacred, fill me with beauty.
Time when we're crossing the threshold into the bottom of the show, and we're going to start to get into some of our What's the Buzz topics. And I think I want to start tonight with some news that came across the internet all week. It was interesting because there was the Catholic News Service was putting out information about how the Vatican was punctuating the fact that to ordain women was such a grave sin. And in the very same week, the Church of England was talking about they were going to ordain women as bishops. And, you know, I thought this, this juxtaposition of these two churches, whose gods are the same, I couldn't help but be a little wicked. And as we were saying on my Facebook page and some of friends on Yahoo lists, we were saying, you know what, they have the same God. Is God whispering one set of rules in the Pope's ear for women and whispering another set of rules in the ears of the Church of England for their women? No, I don't think so. You know, this was such a blatant and obvious transparency of man-made dogma. And it is really such a shame that the Vatican can't adopt inclusiveness, compassion, you know, embrace women as an equal gender. It just really is sad. And I think when you see their decision up against the more progressive and probably flourishing Church of England, as opposed to you know, Catholicism, which, you know, churches are more and more empty every day. They can't even get priests. Well, you know, it's because they just aren't changing with the times. It's still a good old boys club, and I guess they would rather let it die out than, you know, embrace a scary women as priests. Yes, boogity boogity. I don't know. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but you know, they are disrespectful. They are disrespectful to women. And I just wanted to make that distinction. And I just thought it was, you know, that comparison. You know, same God, different churches, man-made dogma. So let's not kid ourselves that the rules that these churches go by are the Word of God. Let's not be duped and programmed that way. You know, some of these churches, they're patriarchal. They oppress women. They are not equal to women in a lot of cases, and that needs to be talked about. That they should not be allowed to continue to sweep that under the rug and say otherwise, or you know, fool people into thinking there's equality, because there's not. And as long as we're on the subject of Christianity, I wanted to share an article that came across the internet, there were some parents who are actually suing their school district, and it's in Allen County. I'm trying to see the state, in Indiana, and you know, it really sort of goes to how Christians are always pushing the envelope, and they manage to get away with it. And what I'm talking about is teaching Christianity in state schools or places where religion is not supposed to be taught. Well, you know, when you see it over and over again, that pushing the envelope, that trying to blur that line between church and state, we saw it in, you know, priests at the pulpit helping Bush promote his war. That's not supposed to happen in the church, because politics is not supposed to be talked about in the church, and the church remain allowed to keep its nonprofit status. We saw it here in California when the Mormons poured tons of money into a vote here that influenced Californians about how they decided to vote for gay marriage. And the Mormons, because they did pour obscene amounts of money into the issue, and they also distorted the message and lied to people about, you know, what gay marriage would do to their children and all sorts of things like that. They, again, you know, they crossed that line between church and state and affected, you know, politics. They, you know, they effectively are preventing gay people from having equality in this country. Look what they did with health care. They held health care hostage over the abortion issue because they have, you know, a lot of politicians in their pocket. Again, you know, it's they're trying to blur that line constantly between church and state. Anyway, these parents in Fort Wayne, Indiana, I'm proud of them. They stood up to the school district and filed suit against them because the school district was actually teaching a religious education class on their campus. Now, this wasn't comparative religions or anything else. As you might imagine from, you know, from my tone and topic, they were teaching Bible study. They were teaching Christianity to kids in public school. And, you know, I think the ACLU should also get involved, because you know what? That is not the way it's supposed to be. And as long as we're talking about inequality in religion, let's just take it a step further, inequality for women in the workplace. I'm not going to read the whole article, but if you are under the impression that women in the United States have equality, well, think again, because this Newsweek article talks about even female law partners suffer wage disparities. Female attorneys within the highest ranks of elite law firms are paid on average roughly $66,000 less than their male counterparts, according to a new study done by the Project for Attorney Retention and the Minority Corporate Counsel Association. The numbers are so stark that it really does call into question whether there's a systemic problem. The study called New Millennium, Stained Glass Ceiling, found that the often cited explanation for the gap, namely that family responsibilities mean women are less ambitious, more distracted, less productive than men, is ultimately an inadequate excuse. The biggest contributing factors, according to the study's authors, are not nearly as benign. They include stereotyping, gender bias, even bullying and intimidation. Of some 700 female lawyers surveyed, more than half of equity partners and two-thirds of income and minority partners say they're dissatisfied with the way compensation was determined at their firms, compared to three-quarters of men who reported high levels of satisfaction with those systems. Complaints include a lack of diversity within compensation committees, a lack of wage transparency, and too much weight given to factors such as billable hours and too little to institutional investments like developing a firm's human capital and nurturing young associates. Female lawyers also reported being stymied by what they called the double bind, saying that for women it's virtually impossible to be simultaneously respected and well-liked. Isn't that interesting? Double bind. They can't be respected and well-liked. They say you must engage in self-promotion, but you're penalized for doing so if you're a woman. One female attorney says she was most surprised by the fact that the survey respondents were so incensed by their experiences at work, which was made clear through comments they submitted online. The anger comes from the fact that they see these patterns of gender bias, double standards, and double binds in their everyday lives. Further fueling that anger is a third of those surveyed reported being threatened, bullied, or intimidated into giving up what law firms call origination credit. If a lawyer is thought of as being responsible for originally bringing in a new client, they can earn 20 to 30% of that client's billing, sometimes for decades after the fact. The conventional wisdom is that women bring in fewer clients because their domestic responsibilities preclude them from being able to go golfing, have late-night dinners, and engage in other activities that cultivate those relationships. But the study found that female lawyers believe that they do just as much rainmaking, but they are denied legitimate claims to credit. This attorney who's been quoted throughout the article says, I was surprised at the fervor and surprised that the way they felt. It was very clear that senior women lawyers are just incensed about their firm's compensation packages. I'm not going to continue with this article, but there is more there. If this is the kind of thing you're interested in, if you need statistics, you can go to Newsweek and go to the article called Even Female Law Partners Suffer Wage Disparities, because at the very end of the article, there are lots of great statistics that point to the inequality of women in the workplace across the board, not just for female lawyers. There's also another good article at Newsweek called Shattering the Glass Ceiling, and I'm not going to go into that one either, but suffice it to say that landmark cases against companies like Novartis and Walmart are wending their way through court and changing the way we all think about work. So Newsweek has some good articles there if you need some statistics for research. Let's see, take something a little bit lighter. I read this a couple years ago, and it was so funny. I think I'm going to read it again because one of my listeners sent it to me, so I always take that as a sign that it would be appreciated out there. We have so many new people listening to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. So this is a phony, a faux email that has been circulated around the internet. We're pretending that it was a letter written to President Bush. Now, whether it actually went to him, who knows? I doubt that he actually read it. But the point really here is about if we're going to follow God's law. Okay, so here's what the letter said, and it's really funny. Dear President Bush, thank you for doing so much to educate people regarding God's law. I've learned a great deal from you and understand why you would propose and support a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. As you said, in the eyes of God, marriage is based between a man and a woman. Well, I try to share that knowledge with as many people as I can. When someone tries to defend the homosexual lifestyle, for example, I simply remind them that in Leviticus 18:22, it clearly states it to be an abomination. End of debate. I do need some advice from you, however, regarding some other elements of God's laws and how to follow them. Number one, Leviticus 25:44 states that I may possess slaves, both male and female, provided they're purchased from neighboring nations. A friend of mine claims that this applies to Mexicans, but not Canadians. Can you clarify? Why can't I own Canadians? Number two, I'd like to sell my daughter into slavery as sanctioned in Exodus 21:7. In this day and age, what do you think would be a fair price for her? Number three, I know that I'm allowed no contact with a woman while she's in her period of menstrual uncleanliness, Leviticus 15:19 through 24. The problem is, how do I tell? I've tried asking, but most women just take offense. Number four, when I burn a bull on the altar as a sacrifice, I know it creates a pleasing odor for the Lord, Leviticus 1:9. The problem is my neighbors. They claim the odor is not pleasing to them. Should I smite them? Number five, I have a neighbor who insists on working on the Sabbath. Exodus 35:2 clearly states he should be put to death. Am I morally obligated to kill him myself, or should I ask the police to do it? Number six, a friend of mine feels that even though eating shellfish is an abomination, according to Leviticus 11:10, is it a lesser abomination than homosexuality? I don't agree. Can you settle this? Are there degrees of abomination? Number seven, Leviticus 21:20 states that I may not approach the altar of God if I have a defect in my sight. I have to admit that I wear reading glasses. Does my vision have to be 20/20, or is there some wiggle room here? Number eight, most of my male friends get their hair trimmed, including the hair around their temples, even though this is expressly forbidden by Leviticus 19:27. How should they die? Number nine, I know from Leviticus 11:6 through 8 that touching the skin of a dead pig makes me unclean, but may I still play football if I wear gloves? And number 10, my uncle has a farm. He violates Leviticus 19:19 by planting two different crops in the same field, as does his wife by wearing garments made of two different kinds of thread, cotton and polyester. He also tends to curse and blaspheme a lot. Is it really necessary that we go to all the trouble of getting the whole town together to stone them? Leviticus 24:10 through 16. Couldn't we just burn them to death at a private family affair like we do with people who sleep with their in-laws? Leviticus 20:14. I know you've studied these things extensively, Mr. Bush, and thus enjoy considerable expertise in such matters, so I'm confident you can help. Thanks again for reminding us that God's word is eternal and unchanging. That's always a hit, so I thought I would share that with you. Now, one of my Voices of the Sacred Feminine fans wrote me. Her name is Penny, and she gave me permission to share what she wrote with me. She got in touch with me because I was talking about Our Lady of the Angels, the huge cathedral built by Bishop Mahoney here in Los Angeles that was really pretty controversial. A lot of people didn't like the cathedral. They really don't like him because of his alleged involvement with, covering for priests who are thought to be pedophiles. Anyway, she said, Karen, I really wish you would give Our Lady of the Angels a second look because I was talking about how it felt cold and they had relegated the Our Lady of Guadalupe Shrine to the outdoors. And so anyway, I just thought what Penny wrote me was so lovely. I would share it with you because she so obviously has found Goddess in this cathedral, Our Lady of the Angels. And Penny says, "Hi, Karen. First of all, thank you so much for your podcast. I've been with the Goddess a long time and appreciate the wonderful access you give us to such important work on her and our behalf. I'm mainly writing to invite you in to consider another perspective regarding Los Angeles' new cathedral. Yes, it was nicknamed the Taj Mahoney because it seemed like Cardinal Mahoney's hubris was the driving force behind it, and aggrandizing his ego was the main goal. But now that it's here, my experience with the new cathedral has been deep, spiritual, and emotional. The Goddess is present in every nook and cranny of that building, and I feel her in the land it sits on, starting with that giant statue of the young Virgin standing on a crescent moon with the framed sky behind as a moving natural halo. You know this is not your ordinary depiction of Mary. She's young and of mixed race. She is Our Lady of Guadalupe and not the draped Madonna of Renaissance painting. And those bronze doors below her, they have different depictions of the Mother of God in all her various Christian incarnations. Also on the doors are various symbols for all the world's religions. I find the statue and the doors to be quite a moving greeting to a most holy and sacred temple. Inside, the architecture guides you into approaching the sanctuary in a measured and slow way to promote separation from the mundane world outside. The walls have contemporary but no less beautiful tapestries that accentuate the golden light that fills the space in the daytime. The walls and the altar have been anointed, blessed, and rubbed with oil by the hands of the bishops. Yes, it was done exclusively by men, but as an ancient tradition, it is no less sacred for having done so. Karen, so many of the old traditions were carried out in the planning and building of this cathedral that I suspect there is a hidden well somewhere in the deep basement. The Goddess is so present that I can't visit the building without tearing up. So if you ever decide to visit the cathedral again, I hope you can experience what I've experienced when I visit there. Just looking up at that beautiful, serene Goddess Mary fills me with peace. Now, I'm a blessed pagan, not a Christian, and certainly not Catholic, so I'm not an apologist for the patriarchy. But my humble experience and opinion, I think Mahoney got it right with the new cathedral, and hope you might give it another chance. That's my soapbox, and I hope it was okay to share with you. It was done with affection and great respect. Keep up the good work, and I'm going to vote for you on the Oprah Show. Well, Penny, thank you so much for writing, and you know what? Because of your letter, I am going to go back there again, and I am going to give it a second look. I'm going to wear my Goddess glasses and try to look at that place through Goddess eyes and not let Cardinal Mahoney's hubris and his reputation poison or mar the experience. Thank you. Thank you for suggesting I do so. And we have more good news to share. It came across the news outlets that Ethiopian female genital mutilation warnings are reaching nomadic women, nomadic girls, and the Danakil Desert of Ethiopia often skip school to fetch and carry water, but in one settled pocket, girls are going to school. And mothers in the past 2 years have begun heeding radio warnings on female genital mutilation. Afari women trek out of the village, Hamid Iladelo, and the schoolmaster at Akersawat, a rural area in the Afar region, is struggling to bring awareness of the benefits of girls' education and the risks of female genital mutilation, or FGM, as we call it. So little by little, little by little. Also, Australia welcomes its first female prime minister. The news is just a little bit late, but you may not know. Her name is Julia Gillard. She became the first female Australian prime minister a couple weeks ago after former Labor leader Kevin Rudd stepped down. Rudd, faced with rising unpopularity after he abandoned a carbon reduction plan and imposed a new mining tax, has now become the shortest-serving Australian prime minister since 1972. But Julia Gillard is considered more left-wing than Rudd, but lawmakers believe she has a better chance of gaining more voters for the embattled Labor party, since she has a warmer personality than her predecessor. Gillard will have a tough challenge in the next general election, however. Several mining companies are expected to pump money and energy into the Conservative Party to have the mining tax repealed. Now, remember, listeners, for my two cents anyway, I'm not a believer in supporting just any woman because she's a woman. Some are just fronts or puppets for keeping things the way they are. Some care little for a caring culture and support the unequal or out-of-balance status quo, but let's see what happens here down under. There was a little bit more on Julia from Micah Stone. He's the Portland Humanist Examiner. He says that Prime Minister Julia Gillard is an atheist, and she has said to the press she doesn't believe in God. When they asked her what her religious affiliation was, she said, "I'm not a religious person." She claims she will not try to court the Christian vote by pretending to have faith. Her exact quote is, "I am not going to pretend a faith I don't feel," unquote. She didn't place her hand on the Bible as she was sworn in as Prime Minister. Instead, she chose to take an affirmation. A Nielsen poll last year found three-quarters of Australians don't care whether political leaders believe in God or not. And I agree with Micah Stone, the author of the article, when he says, obviously, Australia is more enlightened than the United States. It's hard to imagine a majority of Americans supporting an atheist for any major public office here in the United States, and I think that is to our detriment. Next up, the Herald Sun had an article called Religious Tolerance, Is It the New Racism? Religious tolerance is the new racism and one of the main causes of persecution of minorities across the world, according to the annual Minority Rights Group International report published just a few days ago. In an overview of government policies, global trends, and personal accounts, the campaign group argues that counterterrorism efforts and economic marginalization are increasingly being associated with religion, not ethnicity. Religious intolerance is the new racism, said Mark Latimer, director of Minority Rights Group International. Many communities have faced racial discrimination for decades but are now being targeted because of their religion. The report notes that Muslims have been increasing targets by authorities in Europe and the United States as part of counterterrorism measures. This is evident from police stop and searches to the U.S. restrictions introduced after a Nigerian Muslim was accused of trying to bomb an airliner on Christmas Day in 2009. The restrictions apply to citizens from 14 countries, 13 of them predominantly Muslim. It also highlighted how religious groups can be the focus of nationalist campaigns, such as in Switzerland, where voters chose in a referendum to ban the construction of new minarets after a campaign by a far-right party. Meanwhile, in Iraq and Pakistan, which are on the front line of the so-called war on terror, attacks against religious minorities have also escalated in recent years. It notes religious groups in Iraq, such as Christians, Mandeans, Baha'i, and Yazidis, have become targets of violence since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. And in Pakistan, the Taliban has targeted Christians for attack through killings, torture, forcible conversions, and burnings of churches. Other discrimination occurs through government registration schemes for religious groups, a practice used in Azerbaijan, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Serbia, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan since 2001. And finally, in Egypt, all ID papers must list religious affiliation, but the choice is restricted to Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. This means the Baha'i cannot get ID papers and therefore cannot work or access health care. So think about it, religious intolerance, the new racism. I think so. Let's see. We have a few more things here. Some more good news. The Methodist Seminary here in Southern California is abdicating Christianity, says the theologian. Evangelicals and conservative Christians are outraged because Claremont School of Theology is turning to a multi-religious one. Claremont's president, the Reverend Jerry Campbell, announced that the seminary will be partnering with Jewish and Islamic schools to offer clerical training to students of various faiths. Students will be trained in their own religious traditions as well as gain understanding of other faiths through shared classes with the Academy for Jewish Religion and the Islamic Center of Southern California. Eventually, the seminary plans to expand its training to include Hinduism and Buddhism, among others. The new consortium of graduate schools, which is believed to be the first of its kind, is being launched to essentially better prepare students for the multi-religious world they are living in. During the announcement, speakers from Claremont noted the need to desegregate religious education and tear down the walls that have long separated them. They repeatedly called for a culture of inclusiveness, tolerance, and pluralism, and stressed the urgency of that call. I say kudos to Claremont. Next up is an article by the AP. It reports that over 115 million widows live in poverty. At least 245 million women around the world have been widowed, and more than 150 million of them live in devastating poverty, according to a new study launched by Sherry Blair, wife of the former British Prime Minister. The most dire consequences are faced by 2 million Afghan widows and at least 740,000 Iraqi widows who lost their husbands as a result of the ongoing conflicts. By widows and their children evicted from their family homes in sub-Sahara Africa, by elderly widows caring for grandchildren orphaned by AIDS crisis, and by children and by child widows aged 7 to 17 in developing countries. Blair says across the world, widows suffer dreadful discrimination and abuse. In too many cases, they're pushed to the very margins of society, trapped in poverty and left vulnerable to abuse and exploitation. She said many are cheated out of their husbands' assets and property and expelled from their family home, and since they have no money, they can't support their children. So misery is heaped on grief. The plight of widows in the shadows of the world is a human rights catastrophe. It's really a hidden humanitarian crisis. They go on to talk about, of course, something needs to be done about this, and I think it's important that we give voice to this, because I think this is one of these things that happens in the shadows, and people really don't get it. Blair says women become widows when their husbands are killed in conflicts, die of disease, including AIDS, or are killed because they work in dangerous conditions, which are the only jobs available to many poor men. When their husbands die, she said, some women are required to be cleansed. Some are erroneously accused of murder or witchcraft. Some are required to marry another member of the family. Many are disinherited and forced out of their homes, and many are raped. According to the report, over 500 million dependent and adult children of widows are caught in a vicious underworld in which disease, forced servitude, homelessness, and violence are rampant, and youngsters are denied schooling, enslaved, or preyed upon by human traffickers. This foundation Blair is working with was established in 1997 to help counter these problems, and she says there are few resources in the world available to help widows achieve a safer, more comfortable existence and to promote their equality and pursue justice on their behalf. So if you want to read that in more detail, you can, I'm sure you can Google it, AP article, 150 million widows live in poverty. These articles are not that hard to find if you look for them. Well, I think that's probably enough. What's the buzz for now? That concludes our What's the Buzz segment for today. And as long as you keep telling me you like this, and as long as there are important things to talk about, I will try to be a voice for the ideals of the great she. We have to really try our best to teach and share the ideas that offset negative and toxic attitudes and that breed intolerance, hate, war, exclusivity, disharmony, injustice, imbalance, all those horrible things. I'll keep reminding you, because I'm your cheerleader. We have to keep working to reach that 100th monkey, to shift that paradigm, to put that morphic field in motion, to change the way things are. As Rajit was saying, we have to birth the goddess culture onto this earth, and the goddess culture is a culture of love. right. I think we're going to go on to announcements right now. And in July, right here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, Men and Goddess will continue next week with ceremonialist magician Poke Runyon talking about the goddess Astarte and the deities of the Canaanites. And no doubt, I'm sure he will talk about the OTA and ceremonial magic. The show topic is officially called A Bridge Between Magic and Paganism. Then after Poke, who's at the top of the hour, I'm going to finish our chat by moving into a discussion with Joyce Chapman. We're going to be talking about how we can realize our dreams. Now, Joyce was actually instrumental in my submitting that Oprah audition. The lady is good, so don't miss her wisdom that she's going to share with us on July 21st. Then July 28th, one of my favorites is returning, Lydia Rule, who you might recall I was saying in the conversation with Rashid, Lydia is in Turkey right now with him on a tour, and Lydia is known for her goddess spirit banners. And we're going to kick off the Sacred Destinations portion of the summer series, discussing goddesses that Lydia has found on her travels in Asia. And that night, at the bottom of the hour, again, this is July 28th, we're going to have Gloria Amendola on the show, talking about sacred places of Mary Magdalene. So stay tuned through the summer and catch these special shows, including an upcoming interview with Margot Adler. And let's see, just to let you know about some stuff happening, goddess events happening here and there and everywhere, I want to first tell you, if you are in the Seattle area, please, on August 27th, don't miss this this talk that Vajrama of the Women's Mysteries of the Ancient Future Sisterhood is going to be doing at the East West Bookshop. The topic of her talk is From a Hidden Stream, The Natural Spiritual Authority of Woman and Planetary Peace. Vajra has been on the show a few times. No doubt you will remember her. If you don't, please go look for her in the archives. I'm sure this will be a good talk. She's always a powerful speaker. She is tuned in. She knows what she's talking about. She is a contemporary priestess who can help us rebirth goddess into society today. So please, if you're in Seattle, go to the East West Bookstore on August 27th from 7 to 8:30. I feel quite certain you will enjoy her talk. And I'm also going to give you a little taste of Vajra at the very end, an affirmation that she wrote along these lines about the natural spiritual authority of woman. That's how we're going to close the show tonight. So moving down the West Coast, if you are interested in submitting a paper, the 7th Conference on the Current Pagan Studies is having their their conference at Claremont Graduate University, January 22nd and 23rd, and the topic is Building Community. After focus on sustainability last year, they want to go further. So the most sustainable action they feel they can take is a conference on building community. So if you want more information about where to submit abstracts, go to paganconference@yahoo.com. That's paganconference@yahoo.com. And there is a there is a underline between the word pagan and conference. Or if you have a problem with that, go to their website, www.paganconference.com. Let's see. Also coming up at the Goddess Temple on September 4th, you will want to know that the fifth in the series of Queen of Your Realm convocations will happen. This convocation's topic is the Queen's Circulation. It's about money, career, and service. That's Saturday, September 4th, 6:30 to 10. It's always a beautiful event, always, always, always. Dinner, ritual favors. You can take home with you. You'll partake in a nice ritual. But more importantly, you will be able to listen to the wisdom of Ava Park. She is the center holder of the Goddess Temple, and she has a lot of wisdom to share about women embracing their queen. So you can go to the Goddess Temple of Orange County .com. They always have a lot of great events happening. For instance, they have Journey Through the Tree of Life with Melinda Alec coming up. And they have Calling All Wild Women, Wild Art Sacred Crown Making, Cosmic Womb Bowl Creation Workshop. Lots of really fun, creative activities there, primarily for women. So check it out, Goddess Temple of Orange County.com. Also, too, if you're interested in Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, it is actually that feminist theology curriculum is going online starting tomorrow. The first five classes in part one are being taught by a good friend of mine, Chris Oster, and I might actually teach the second part. So I'll keep you apprised of that and let you know if I do. I'm going to be sitting in on the first session and seeing how that all goes, learning how to do a webinar. So I thank Chris for allowing me to sit in and watch her in action so she can teach me how to do that so I can in turn take some of my work out to you in the world, because a lot of you have said, you know what, Karen, I want to hear what you have to say. I want you to teach me, but I'm not in Southern California, so please, can you put your stuff online? Well, this is a step in that direction. So, Cakes for the Queen of Heaven start tomorrow and are going to be running for five Thursdays in a row. And if you want more information, email me at KarenTate.com. And remember, you might have heard me say it before, but I like it. My motto, have sistrum will travel. Sistrum is a sacred musical instrument of the goddess. Anyway, that's just my little saying to tell you that I'm available to talk to your group or church if you want to sponsor me to come to your city. Have sistrum will travel. And I am in deep conversation with Rashid, our guest tonight, about putting a tour to Turkey together in October of next year. We are very close to having everything finalized. We're only going to take 20 people. It's going to be for women and men. My husband always comes along, so this is not a woman's only trip. So I invite you to consider it, and if you're interested, let me hear from you, because we are going to just take a small group, and if you have any questions, please let me know. Well, if you heard that sound, you know that means that we are getting ready to sort of shift gears here and refocus our energy. And we're going to go into closing the show with tonight's evening affirmation by Vajrama. And I thank her for letting me use this tonight. It was so beautiful that I'm sure you will enjoy it as much as I did when I read it. So I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me. Sort of go to that place in your center where you can have a deeper focus and really hear these words. We can begin to shift our consciousness and go within. Go within to that place where we connect with the divine and hear her speak to us, our mother, our sacred self. Women today need direct, undiluted knowledge in order to accomplish the transformation of humanity and civilization that only women can vanguard. Only woman can bring humanity back into right relationship. Why women? Because the current paradigm of authority through domination of life, through force rather than a natural relationship with life, is a male-centered paradigm. A paradigm that has led us to the brink of destruction. The collective consciousness of patriarchy has separated itself from the source of life, lost its sense of relationship, and suppressed its feeling. It is raping and pillaging the very source of life, earth and women. On the deepest creature level, there is a profound difference between the doomed collective patriarchal consciousness, which is innately disconnected, and that of the individual male person, which is not. But once it started going off course, becoming a collective, it had to formulate institutions, laws, governments, prohibitions, and religion. Like two paths that first only diverge slightly over time, one can no longer see the other path. It disappears, and the path one is on seems to be the only one there is. And this is how soul truths come about. And while no single woman can or would likely claim any sort of papal infallibility, woman is the embodiment of feminine power and wisdom, endowed with the sensibilities of life giver, indeed can and should know herself collectively as the only true authority. What is needed is the reassertion of woman's collective consciousness, a collective wisdom that far exceeds the wisdom of any individual person. As no single male human should be made to bear the burden of patriarchal destruction, women cannot really do this work in isolation, but rather by resting in woman as the collective, inclusive source. Such a collective consciousness includes the morphic resonance that reverberates just beneath the surface of our experience as the hidden but ever-living stream from the tens of thousands of years of woman's spiritual and cultural leadership. Whew, I think she said it beautifully. Vajrama now is on Facebook. She has a Facebook page for the Southern Oregon Temple of the Goddess, but she also has her new site up, Woman Mysteries of the Ancient Future Sisterhood. You can actually go read this for yourself there. It's one of her notes that's posted. And remember, if you like what she has to say, and I'm sure you probably do if you're of like mind with me, if you're in Seattle, please make sure you go see her at the East West Bookshop on August 27th. Put that on your calendar. So, listeners, I want to thank you again for tuning in this week. I want to thank you for everyone out there who voted for me in the Oprah audition. I think we sent a very powerful intention into the ethers, and we will have to see what develops from our magic. So, as I close the show for tonight, let me say, let us be her roar. Let us be her roar. I'm talking about Goddess's Roar. Let us be her voice. So good night, and thanks for tuning in. I hope you'll be back with us next Wednesday night at 6 o'clock Pacific or from the archives. I'm going to leave you with, Breath of Passion by Zingaya. Hope you enjoy it. Good night, and see you next week.